Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is episode 368. It's an Aftershock Monday episode, and I'm actually recording this little intro at the Denver airport. I'm about to fly out from Denver Comic Con. Really great weekend, so look for our wrap-up show from that coming soon. And I also got a chance to sit down with Zach Kaplan at the show and talk about his upcoming series from Aftershock, Lost City Explorers, which has me very, very excited. Also on this episode, you're going to hear an interview I did with Sean Lewis. Some of you may remember he was on the show previously to talk about his Betrothed series from Aftershock, and he has the final order cut off for a new series called Clan Killers, which is a bit darker, I'll say, but I'll let you listen to the interview and hear all about it. So if you're interested in Clan Killers, be sure you let your retailers know before this coming Friday so they can pre-order it for you. And also I'll mention with Zach's interview, we do talk a little bit at the end about his Top Cow series, Port of Earth. So I'm sure all you Aftershock listeners will be happy to hear about that series as well, and support Zach with his Top Cow series as well as his Aftershock Comics upcoming Lost City Explorers. So as always, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. This is episode 368, Aftershock Monday. And we're here to talk to you today about a new series that's about to come out from Aftershock. The final order cutoff is this Friday, Clan Killers. And I have writer Sean Lewis joining me again on the show. Some of you may remember that Sean joined previously to talk about his other Aftershock title, Betrothed. Welcome back to the show, Sean. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Sure. So let's dive right in here. Why don't you give our listeners an idea of what Clan Killers is all about?
Sure. Well, I think it's been getting described around the offices mostly as Game of Thrones meets Kick-Ass. It basically follows two teenagers, Fionnuala and Cillian, in kind of medieval Ireland, who Fionnuala, her dad, Padre the Grotesque, is this kind of like evil ruler of the land. And like most girls or kids, she just wants her dad to love her, and he does not. So her response is to basically burn everything down. So it's a very cheery book.
Yeah, I've never seen Game of Thrones. I know you listeners are gonna like, don't throw things at me when you see me. But I've never seen Game of Thrones. I very much did get a little bit of a Braveheart vibe from it, and I can really see the Kick-Ass aspect as well. But the other thing that's really cool about it is because you are telling the story of rebellious teenagers. I think in a way we can all, like, any of us who've been teenagers, remember that time. We remember, regardless of whether our parents were evil or not, you know, ruling kingdoms or whatever, there were things they did and kind of laws they laid down that we didn't like, that we bristled against. So I think in that way, it's very much relatable.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the back and forth and the push and pull of a parent and child's love is definitely relatable, and is just like a constant journey of just like, where do I fit in this relationship as I get older, and how do I show that I love and also gain my own independence, and how do they show that they love and like give me room is always a big question.
Yeah. And you know, we mentioned your other title from Aftershock, Betrothed. And so I couldn't help knowing that you write that. I love that story. It's been interesting and fun, you know, learning the world that the two main characters are from, and also seeing their place in our world. So I couldn't help, as I was reading the first issue of Clan Killers, to kind of compare them in my mind. And this is really also exploring teenage angst in a way, but this is a much darker tale than Betrothed. So what made you want to kind of go down the path of a little more brutal, let's say?
Well, it's funny. I think Clan Killers is probably more in my wheelhouse of what I normally do than Betrothed. I think even when we talked last, like, Betrothed came very much for me out of, I'd done like three really heavy books in a row, and I just started thinking like, I wanted to do something lighter. And I also had been getting really obsessed and thinking about like what books were out there and in the market for people who were like under the age of 21. Like what is there for a teen and middle school audience? Where Clan Killers, I mean, myth, darkness, war, fighting, nihilism, unfortunately, those are very much like It's very much like where my daily thought is. So it feels very comfortable to write that world. So yeah, I think the books are, it's interesting. They have that similar kind of like young man, young woman at the center of it, but I think they're astronomically different books.
Yeah, I agree. And both stories are kind of rooted in classic stories. You know, there's obvious comparisons in Betrothed to like Romeo and Juliet. In this story, it looks like you're really going to be exploring the myth, which I always find fascinating. You know, a lot of my ancestry is Irish. So do you find that you're always drawn to those kind of classic stories and they inform your storytelling style, whether it's old myth or it's Shakespeare or whatever it might be?
I mean, myth for sure, I get drawn to a lot. Shakespeare, I mean, I come from a theater background. And I mean, when I first had talked with Aftershock about doing these two books, in my mind, they were both going to be wildly drastic takes on Shakespeare plays, like Betrothed, obviously being informed by Romeo and Juliet. And then Clan Killers for me was very much going to be informed by King Lear. With the three daughters, and there's a king at the center of it who's demanding love all the time. I just was going to set it in a very brutal Ireland. But yeah, I think I do get drawn to myths a lot. When I was a kid, that's like all I read, is I used to take out books of myths, like the Bullfinch's mythologies, and I would pour through them. I mean, I think the idea of gods and demons and monsters was weirdly comforting for like a very misfit version of me as a kid. So I think like, yeah, when I'm writing stuff, there's just so much I think you can do and talk about when you're dealing with myth. Like, it just gives you a really nice allegory to work from. And I think it's also approachable for audiences because there's a level of mystical and magical that makes the world look like ours, but there's something new to it that we want to learn about.
Yeah, I agree. And it's, again, I mean, you've got that touchstone of you're telling the story of teenagers, right? And trying to find their place in the world. But I think a lot of us in our childhood were introduced to myth and a lot of these kind of mythical creatures through fairy tales, right? Like a lot of us, those
sure.
were bedtime stories. So I really think it's kind of a natural place to relate. But what's interesting, and I'm sure you know that, is that in reality, a lot of the fairy tales that we got when we were kids were kind of like the anglicized, like a whitewashed version, right? And it sounds to me like maybe you dove past that into the actual stories that were told back then. I think a lot of people don't realize how dark they really were, right?
Oh, they're massively dark. I mean, one of the big things is, when I was growing up, I lived in the same house as like my grandparents and my uncles. And I had one uncle who was really obsessive about like older arcane stuff, and he would collect. I remember he had these books that had to do with Celtic magic, and he used to always warn me. I had to be like 9 years old. He'd always be like, "Don't read that book. That book's real." And it'd be like a book of like Celtic spells. So of course I would get obsessed and I'd read it. And like with the spells, they would talk about like the origin of it, which would have some of these stories of like what exactly the banshee did, what exactly was a Dullahan, what are the deers. Like all these kind of myths that are like just Irish versions of vampires and monsters and headless horsemen. And yeah, the stories are like incredibly dark and they never end well. Like there's never a happy ending when someone runs into one of the monsters. So yeah, I think that those things have definitely stayed with me since I was a kid.
Yeah. And I want to talk about that idea of having no heroes, but I want to ask you this first. So when you went to tell this story, like sat down to actually write it, you probably didn't have to really do a lot of research, right? Like you kind of had been researching for this your whole life with your love of these kind of like original folk tales and myth that were rooted in darkness, really, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's through the monsters. I mean, I understood those a lot, and the play King Lear comes from a king that they think either was Irish or Scottish that Shakespeare was writing about. So I knew a lot of the history of that from having worked on the play years and years ago. So it definitely felt like comfortable, like the moment I started working on it, in terms of like, oh, where are we? And also, like, to be honest, I tend to give myself some leeway too. Is like, I know I'm writing fiction. So there's a part of me where I'm like, do I want to focus on if we're like, which part of the medieval or dark ages are we in? Or is that the most important thing, or do I want to really nail the character behaviors and the design of the monsters and their own wants and longings?
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to be too beholden to some idea or era, or you know, you can kind of lose the forest for the trees if you go down that path.
Right.
So you mentioned that a lot of these stories don't necessarily have heroes, and I wanted to ask you if you could give us a little more on Princess Fanola, because she does. I mean, she seems to be our protagonist, like the one we're gonna root for. But like, is she a hero? Like, I don't know that I would. Right, really the classic heroine doesn't seem like it. And you had mentioned
no, she's
fairy tales.
She's though. Definitely an anti. She's definitely an anti-hero. You know, it's very much like when you. I in some ways, I grew up really obsessed with Vertigo books, and I think you can have the same argument as, like, is Jesse and Preacher a hero? Like, or is he the guy that you're following and everything in the world is already dark? He's just a little bit lighter than them. You know, I think I get fascinated by that, is like, what is the context kind of determines role, right? Like, if you're in a pitch black world, you being gray makes you probably the hero. As opposed to if you're in a world with a lot of light, Fanola would be in a reform school.
Right.
You know, like she would put her behind bars. She's kind of a sociopath. And Cillian, or like her compatriot Cillian is as bad, if not somewhat worse in some ways. And I think that's interesting, is like, I don't know, maybe it's the world we're living in right now, but like how you respond to your surroundings is something I think is really fascinating. So if the world is telling you that everything is bad, do you respond like Mother Teresa, or do you try and come back twice as strong as the world is coming at you? And I think Fanola's decision is, I'm just going to be twice as dangerous as everyone else around me in order to survive this.
No, you also have to allow for the fact that she hasn't exactly had a normal childhood, right? I mean, her father was, you know, she's just trying to grow up and find her place in the world. And yeah, she longs for the love of somebody that she, you know, doesn't necessarily connect with and sees doing these terrible things. So, you know, I think in that way, as much as we can relate to her as a teenager and being rebellious, I don't know that, I mean, I hope a lot of us can't relate to the world of monsters, including her father.
Right. No, I mean, that is true. I mean, she is surrounded by so much violence. But I mean, even in the first issue, like the way that her and Cillian deal with each other, there's a level of gentleness,
right,
that the rest of the world doesn't have. You know, so even though you have these two kids who are complete outcasts and like in their own right are kind of dangerous and screwed up, you can kind of tell as they embrace and hug after certain things that it's like, oh, they have completely found each other, and there's an actual like love there that is missing in their lives otherwise. I mean, because also the first issue, you go into the church and you see how even the priests and the church is behaving, and you're like, oh, this world has no salvation. Like, there's no salvation or redemption in this place. Like, the priests are as bad, if not worse, than the murderers running around.
So as the first issue winds down and we kind of get an idea of what Finn's kind of mission, her mission statement, what she's gonna do going forward, or what, you know, what her goal is, would you say as the series moves forward that it really is Finn's story, or is it gonna be a wider story of you know, the whole world, the kingdom, and the other characters that you've established?
I mean, you're going to see all of those things, but it'll all center around Fanola and her journey. You know, it's very much about like, how is she going to return to her father, and what is that going to do? Like, is she going to kill him? Are they going to reconcile? Is she going to get his love, or by the end of this, is it going to matter anymore if she does or not? That's definitely the crux of what we're watching. She's just kind of building a weird supernatural army around it so that she can fight her dad. I mean, that basically is just how bad her dad is. You know, it's like the people she has to bring off the bench to help her are pretty monstrous.
Yeah, and she really seems to be kind of motivated by revenge, which can, you know, that's been a motivator in, you know, for as long as stories have been told. And oftentimes if you focus so much on the revenge aspect of the character, I think you can kind of, the character becomes kind of one note. We expect to see some growth from Finn? I'm like, while she goes on this journey and tries to complete this quest she's kind of put for herself, are we going to see her kind of grow up a little bit?
Oh, absolutely. I think invariably, you know, like it's a very classic motif, the revenge motif. I mean, that goes back to like even Greek plays. And the one thing that they all kind of hold in common is that revenge tends to devour the person who feels it. So they either like have to change or they get destroyed by their own like hubris, their own obsession with it. And I think, yeah, Fionnuala, I mean, it's also like they're right at the age where they're going to become adults, Fionnuala and Cillian. So it's like their entire growth in who they're going to become in the future is going to be determined by like how the rest of this quest, you know, funnels their needs. Like if they stay revenge-based and become consumed, what does that mean? Versus do they find other things along the way that are more meaningful?
So revenge, we know revenge is going to be a theme and maybe we could say that personal growth for them. Are there any other things that you're hoping to, any other themes you're hoping to explore with this story?
I think I am really obsessed and interested with the context and the construct of societies. Is that if the world around, I was saying it before, but it's something I think about on a daily basis. How do you respond to things and what determines them? Like I think about things like Twitter and I'm like, Twitter can be such a community-based thing if you're interacting with the right people, but it also like you can see on a daily basis, like entire groups of people like destroying someone on Twitter. It can be so incredibly like negative.
Right.
And you're just kind of, and like what I always am amazed by is the people who like receive some negativity on that, which the stakes are so low, and their response is to be like twice as negative back. And you're just kind of, I'm kind of fascinated by that. Like when the world attacks you, how do you interact with it? Like what does it teach you to do? Do you respond, you know, gregariously, or do you try and fight back, and which is the best mode? And like, I do think that there's an interesting conversation in that, is that when you're in dark times, how do you interact with it?
That is a extremely complex question, and you're right. We could probably, you and I could probably sit here and talk about that for ad infinitum, because there's so, I mean, it is a fascinating thing to think about, right? Like, because we're all different and unique in our own ways. So we see every situation differently and we're going to react to every situation differently. And, you know, you may react positively in one situation and negatively in another, and the roles could flip flop. And they are, I mean, as it applies to clan killers, it is a very dark world, you know, with monsters and demons and depravity that we've seen so far. And so, yeah, put yourself in that world. Like, how would you react? It's a big rabbit hole to go down for sure, Sean.
Yeah. I mean, it's something that I mean, like there was even an article today in the New York Times that was talking about how to deal with insults, like between people who have political disagreements. And it was arguing for like, well, when you insult someone back, you're going down a rabbit hole that no one benefits from. And then I was seeing like all the responses and comments to it. People are like, no, you're an idiot. You're wrong. Like I'm in a world where someone insults me, I'm going to insult them worse. And you're like, huh, this is an interesting society that starts to get built when you start to move down that direction. Right? Like it's very Old Testament.
Yeah.
Like this kind of eye for an eye behavior. Like if you hurt me, I'm going to hurt you twice as bad.
Yeah. I feel like
it's interesting.
We're not even an eye for an eye. We're in like eye for an eye and an arm. And then I'm going to eye and an arm and a leg pretty soon.
Yeah. No, I feel the same way. It does very much feel right now that like insults are like perceived assaults are responded to in like twice as much fashion. It's scary. I mean, I think that scares me. And I think everything I write has some level of curiosity about fascism. Like I get very obsessed with the idea of people who want to try and control the way you behave. And again, I would say that I feel like that no matter what you think politically, I have a general fear of people in power to begin with, because the whole concept of power is built on me manipulating you to agree with me.
Right. Yep.
And so I look at those things and on a regular basis, and I'm just like, I want to just live a very like nice, comfortable, easy, happy life with my friends and closest family. And the moment that I start feeling like myself or other people around me are getting twisted in other directions, it just makes me wonder about the social constraints that exist that cause that.
Yeah, and I mean, sometimes something for the greater good may not necessarily benefit us. And so there are sacrifices you make for living in this society. But I tend to agree with you. It's like there needs to be, especially in this day and age, I feel like, a little more live and let live, you know? Like,
yeah,
a lot of things that people want to do that don't necessarily affect me. Like, why do I need to have an opinion on whether that's right or wrong?
Absolutely. I mean, I feel like that often is I'm just like, in terms of like social things, if it doesn't affect me, I'm like, I don't really care. I mean, all the joy to you.
Yeah.
I also think on the opposite side of things too, I'm like, if people disagree with you, there's a general level of like, we don't accept disagreement anymore. That if someone disagrees with you on any opinion, no matter how wrong you think they are, like, I don't know, we live in a society that is built that as a tenet, right? Of like, you can say whatever you want as long as you're not like causing harm to people.
Right. Yep.
And that becomes an interesting thing to me. Like the idea of thought control is very scary to me.
Yeah, I agree. There is almost a level of closed-mindedness now. Like, if you don't agree with my opinion, you're wrong. No.
Yes.
That if you don't agree with what I think, it just means we disagree. It doesn't mean you're wrong.
Right.
I accept the possibility that I could be wrong.
Right. Right. And you have the right to say that you disagree with me. Like, once we start getting into, like, you disagree with me, so I think you should no longer have a job. Or you disagree with me, so I don't think you should be allowed to vote. That's when it becomes like, wait, where are we?
Yeah.
What are we doing? That gets really scary to me.
The id has taken over. It's the problem. Or the ego. Yeah. You could think of it one way or the other. Well, let's bring it back to Clan Killers, because this is always happens when I have you on. You and I start going down these awesome
things. I know. Sorry.
It's awesome. I love it. Love it. We need to, you know, get together at a show sometime and go out for drinks and just solve all the world's problems, Sean and I.
Absolutely.
But let's talk a little bit about working with your artist on the book, Antonio Fuso. What's that been like?
He's great. I mean, he's awesome. When I first saw his art, so Mike Marks, the editor-in-chief, had sent me some of his work. And it reminded me, like, I think I've said so many times in interviews for other books, like, how obsessed I was with Vertigo growing up. And it looked to me like a lot of old Vertigo books. It just had this really classic, dark feel to it. And I was like, okay, he's the perfect one for the book. Like, I mean, that was one of those things where I just knew right away. I mean, that's the nice thing when you look at art and you're like, oh, there's nobody I can imagine doing this book besides him.
What I loved about him was, despite the darkness we get from Fanola, like, you kind of understand, oh, this girl's kind of messed up. The way that he drew her, she seems so young and innocent, and it's
right.
So great to see the visual part of the story where she looks one way, but the things coming out of her mouth are completely
unreal. It's true. She is like such a tomboy in her design. And then I also love that you have Cillian, who has like the worst haircut on the planet. Like, he just looks like a kid who sat behind you in social studies. and they're running around causing chaos.
Yeah, I can't wait to see where it goes from here. And I'm hoping we're going to see a lot more like demons and monsters and Antonio.
Oh, yeah.
Stretch those muscles.
Yeah, there's a lot of those to come. There's a new one basically every issue. So you'll get a chance to see a lot of that stuff.
Awesome. Well, I don't want to keep you, Sean. I know you have things to get to. Are there any other projects that you want to plug real quick for our listeners, other than Betrothed that we mentioned, that they should be on the lookout for?
Sure. I mean, it looks like it's going to be a pretty busy year for me. I mean, I'm doing a book called Coyotes that finished its first arc a couple of months ago that we come back. We actually released the same month, I think, as Clan Killers. So me and Caitlin Yarsky are doing that. I'm excited for that. And then Hayden Sherman, who I did The Few with, me and him have a new book that I think we'll be able to announce pretty soon. So yeah, it's exciting. It's fun to get a chance to do all this stuff.
Yeah, that's awesome. So if any of our listeners want to follow along social media, they'll know when that new book with Hayden is announced and everything. Where's the best place to follow you on social media?
The best place is at Sean Chris Lewis, S-E-A-N, then just Chris Lewis as one word.
Great. And I'll put links to the social media in the show notes for everybody. Again, Sean, thanks for joining me. It's always great to have you on. Best of luck.
Yeah, it was good talking to you too.
Yeah, I can't wait to read more of the story. The first issue definitely had me wanting more.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks for taking the time.
No problem. Anytime.
All right, man. Take care.
All right, this is Jace coming to you once again from Denver Comic-Con. I have one of my favorite writers here, Zach Kaplan. Zach, thanks for joining me. It's great to see you,
hey,
man.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so I'm going to talk a little bit about a couple different titles that you have out right now.
Yeah.
Let's start with Lost City Explorers at Aftershock.
Yeah.
Issue 1 drops the 20th, is that right?
Issue 1 drops on Wednesday.
This Wednesday.
Right coming up this week.
Yeah, okay, great.
The dates are flying by. We actually have an exclusive here at Denver Comic-Con. Jen Bartel and Triona Farrell did a gorgeous variant cover, and it's a Denver Comic-Con exclusive only.
Here in my bag.
Yeah, it's really cool. So it was great to actually see the book in print, but it comes out this Wednesday.
Yeah, so let's let our listeners know, what quick pitch, what's the story all
yeah,
about?
It's an homage to young adult adventure. I grew up on Goonies and loving Stranger Things, and it's a modern story, and it follows a group of millennial teenagers. One of them discovers that their father was involved in a research expedition underneath New York City, and something's gone terribly wrong. And in the process of trying to solve what happened to her father and go looking for him, they find out that there may be a lost city of Atlantis buried underneath New York City. And the story is a real mash of archaeology and lost city mythology and science fiction and urban exploration.
Right, and we want all you listeners to go out there and pick it up, so not to spoil too much, but obviously I've read the first issue, and the main character, Helen, or Hel, she seems kind of lost in the beginning, right?
Yeah.
So right away what I got was, you could take it as Lost City Explorers, like exploring or searching for a lost city, or you could take it as they're lost in themselves, in life, right?
Absolutely. Yes, that was what I loved about the title. Lost City Explorers can play in a lot of different ways. They are explorers of lost cities, or they are city explorers who are also themselves lost. And there's a lot of double entendre and meaning in that title. But for me, as any great story about an ensemble cast of young adults, it's really about these teenagers trying to find themselves, or just dealing with the fact that they don't entirely have a grip on things. And so, yes, it definitely starts off, and she is a very dramatic young woman who's very lost in her own anguish and torment about what's going on in her life. But rightfully so. I mean, this is a girl who lost her mother when she was younger. Her father's been obsessed with work, and she's essentially been raising herself for the past year or two that she's been living in New York City. So she is very much lost and unsure what she wants out of life.
And one other aspect that I want to mention, because your stories always have great settings, like, you know, Eclipse, Lost City Explorers, Port of Earth, another great setting. But it's also character first. Your character is so interesting. And so it also seems like Hell's going to be also kind of searching for meaning and the ways to make these relationships work. You mentioned the relationship with her father. She doesn't seem to have a very good relationship with her brother either.
No, yeah, that's one of the most central relationships. Her brother's older. He's a little more well-adjusted. He's dealt with some of the pain that they've gone through in their lives by ignoring it. So Hel likes to confront pain in a very dramatic way, and he likes to avoid it, and they're really at each other's throats. And of course, it's absolutely about them trying to find some sort of peace, especially in the absence of both of their parents. So and actually Lost City Explorers, more than ever for me, was a dive into trying to really spend even more time with the characters in issue one, and hoping that with an exciting hook at the top and kind of an exciting cliffhanger and the parameters for what the adventure could be, that I could just spend a little more time so you'd really understand who these characters were, and especially who Hal and her brother Homer are, before we launch into the ride that will be the adventure. So
yeah, because I it's so interesting. They're such polar opposites, and so I can't wait to kind of see the arc you take them on, because I expect growth from both characters.
Yeah.
And in the end, they may like come to find a common ground and turn out they're more alike than they think, right?
Yeah, that would be... it writes itself in some ways, but it's always fun to see the nuance of how that happens.
Right, exactly.
And how, in what ways they're challenged, and how will they be challenged on an urban exploration underneath New York City, and what will it be about this particular adventure that brings them together. So, yeah, and I think the whole group, it's an ensemble cast. It's a very eclectic, diverse cast. Homer's got his girlfriend, who's a Muslim American, who's very westernized by pop culture and potentially annoying at the onset of the yeah. book, but rightfully so, because she's got some growth to have. And Hell's best friend is a very ride or die loyal girlfriend who is just really hard, and she has some growth. So they all have kind of growth. They're all not cohesive, and it's all about them kind of coming together in the very end too. So yeah.
Now, Sagan Labs, the corporation that was funding her dad's research, right away in the beginning we get this feeling like everything might not necessarily be on the up and up. So was there like a conspiracy, evil corporation aspect to it?
I think there's definitely some of that, but it's more just, I tried to get away from the black. I never like to do black and white.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever I think about the characters who are working for Sagan Labs, they're just trying to protect their best interests. And actually one of the characters that starts off in issue one, Adam Glenn, who works for Sagan Labs, is kind of their young 20-something point man on this project. He kind of finds himself in the middle of this boat, because on the one hand, he works for Sagan, but on the other hand, he kind of identifies with what these kids are going through. But yeah, Sagan is definitely deeply involved, and there's and we're going to learn a lot more as the story goes on about what's going on with this research project and how this all works, and what is behind, what's the connection between the science fiction and the lost cities.
Well, I can't wait to read more. Issue one was fantastic. So
thank you.
So thank you for that, Zach. Let's switch gears here. Let's touch a little bit on your project for Top Cow.
Yeah.
We have a couple there, but specifically Port of Earth.
Yeah.
Issue six just came out recently. The second volume, and what I find so interesting is it's almost like the Earth security agents have switched roles. Like in the beginning, we had
yes
one that was like so gung-ho, and the other was like hell, and now he lost his girl, and all of a sudden the roles have been switched.
Yes.
So can you talk a little bit about that kind of dynamic?
Yeah, I mean, it was so funny, because when issue one, this was always my vision for mm-hmm. this. And by issue eight ends with a tremendous amount of closure, and it'll be very fulfilling. And issue one sets up these two characters, and I remember reading some responses that people loved the world and loved the setup, but thought these characters were very, like, one's by the book, and one is xenophobic towards aliens, and I was just in my mind going, just you wait.
Just
because
wait.
Because once the by the book character, Agent Rice, he basically is trying his very best to buy into this idea that the ESA has, and the Earth Security Agency has this idea that they're there to protect humans and aliens alike. And there's this counter-argument that this is impossible to do, and that essentially the ESA is picking sides and siding always to support the aliens over the human
right.
life, which is where McIntyre's frustration comes from, mm-hmm. this sentiment. And Rice, for his whole life and his whole career with the ESA, has tried to buy into this. And when he loses his girlfriend and sees the toll, he can't take it anymore. And so he's now processing his pain in a very angry way. And you're seeing what happens when the reasonable character breaks. And the guy who was actually loose and, you know, maybe had his own issues is now actually
now
trying
the voice
to,
of reason.
The voice of reason. And it just, it fascinates me when we have these moments of extremity in our world, which modern day we have a tremendous amount
right.
of,
yep.
of extremes. And it really is a tragedy when the pragmatist, or the voice from the reason, breaks or cracks. And when that happens, we're really in trouble. And it's always interesting to see who steps up and how that plays out, or if that person is able to regain a sense of reason in a tragedy. So yeah, it's been a really exciting second arc to dig into that character dynamic that I couldn't wait to break. The volume one is all about the status quo for these agents, and volume two is all about the broken, you know, aftermath of it all. So yeah, it's been a lot of fun to write.
Have you had a lot of feedback from readers as well? Like, oh, I can't believe you flipped them.
I think they're just getting into it. I mean, six just came out.
Yeah,
and I especially imagine too. I mean, there's definitely a diehard loyal contingent of issue readers, but I think it'll even read even better as a graphic. Because you'll get to just stay with these characters without stopping.
Right.
So, you know, I know there people, I mean, issue 7 is very exciting because we actually go to Port of Earth. So for all this time I've been talking about the Port of Earth and people don't actually go, issue 7, we see it. So there's some fans that are so into the series that they just can't wait to see I want to see the port, I want to see what's going to happen. But just in terms of that second arc and seeing this character drama play out with these two guys, I think it's going to really make sense when you read it all together.
Yeah, and I would encourage you listeners, you know, Zach and I don't have a lot of time here. We're a little limited. So I think if you want to know more about Port of Earth, we did a spotlight on it where Zach and Manny and I really dove deep on it, talked about how topical and how kind of prescient it was that you came up with this idea, and then with the election that happened, then all of a sudden it became even more prescient. So thanks for your time, Zach. It's always great to have you.
Thank you very much.
Anything else you want to let
us know? Yeah, I'll just mention one more thing. Eclipse, my first series, World Where the Sun Will Burn You Alive. That's coming back August 1st. It is the new arc is amazing. I am so excited about this arc. The artwork is amazing. We spent a lot of time over the hiatus really crafting the story. If you guys have liked what we started with Eclipse, come on back and check it out, because it's gonna be awesome.
Yeah, and Zach Kaplan on...
I'm on all platforms at Zach Caps, and feel free to reach out and chat, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram.
Yeah, and I'll put links to all the social media in the show notes for everybody. And one more quick thing, I can't believe we forgot to mention the art on Lost City Explorers.
Oh yeah, it's great. Alvaro Saraceca, thank you so much. And he's amazing. Chris Blythe is the colorist, does a great job. And Alvaro was a newcomer, just done Turok and Magnus. He captures both the world, but more importantly, the nuance of emotion in those characters, and he's phenomenal. I'm blessed. I mean, I'm between Giovanni and Andrea Moody, and now Alvaro. I'm a very lucky man so far.
Yeah,
I'm
definitely
working with great artists.
Yeah, every one of them knocked it out of the park, and specifically on Lost City Explorers, very much an urban feel and an urban color palette, which was just perfect for the book.
Yeah, very.
Okay, thanks a lot, Zach.
Thank you very much.